My name is Ray Park. You may know me as playing Darth Maul in the Phantom Menace, Clone Wars, and also Solo at Star Wars Story. You're listening to Star Wars Stuff Podcast, The Force is Strong with You All. And remember, Sith Walk.
Hey, this is Dominic Pace, who plays Gecko the Bounty Hunter from The Mandalorian, letting you all know you are listening to the Star Wars Stuff Podcast. Wishing everybody all the best, and may the Force be with you.
May the Force be with you!
Hey guys, welcome to Star Wars Stuff Podcast. This is Retro Ray. We are here with Zach, and we have a special guest as well, and Zach is going to introduce them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But before we get to that, we're going to thank our comic book sponsors who help us out and provide comics for some of the coverage that is coming up that Ray and I will be covering with Mace Windu and Jango Fett and Thrawn and High Republic. Lots coming that way. So huge shout out to Lang's Comics and Collectibles out in Muskegon, Michigan.
And then kind of we're also going to do a sponsor for that gives us the same thing, our comics here. It's basically Dragon's Lair Alamo Ranch in San Antonio. Big shout out to them. We wouldn't be able to do any of this stuff without the sponsors and our Patreons, which we're going to get to next.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see here. It's coming up. I got to remember all these names off the top of my head here, Ray. We should probably have that down at this point.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. I can't pronounce a lot of the names that are on here.
No, it's okay. It's okay if we get the list going. Well, you can find us on Patreon at Star Wars Stuff Podcast 2187. In case you forget the last four digits, it's Princess Leia's cell number on the Death Star or Finn Stormtrooper number. So we have Hayden Hauser, Darth Ace One, Liam McCallion, Chris Simpson, Kevin Leiniger, Devin McCaffrey, Drew Peters, Zach Netzel, Fenrir 526, Maya Morris, and Maka Tal Tala. Thank you so much to all our patron supporters. We could not do any of this without you guys. And we are excited to jump into this special episode today. And I'll bring in our guest for him to introduce himself and what he's all about.
How are
you guys? Welcome.
my name is Tom Spina. I operate Tom Spina Designs and Regal Robot. Tom Spina Designs is a company where we've been going for almost two decades doing restoration of original movie props, creating things like props and creatures for some of the Star Wars content out there, working on things for Star Wars Land and theme parks and collectors everywhere, everything from, you know, bronze statues and wax figures all the way through restoring the most priceless artifacts you ever found that were used in films. And then Regal Robot is our second business, where we have the license with Lucasfilm and Disney to do officially licensed replicas from Indiana Jones and Star Wars, as well as some like really weird and wild decor type stuff, which is just, you know, sort of things we do for fun. But yeah, so that's the shortest possible version of a very long story. So thanks for having
me. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for being on, Tom. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day, your busy life to chat it up with some people who love Star Wars, hopefully just as much as you do. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Since I was, well, bigger than that, I don't know about, however big I was in 77, it was about five. So maybe about yay big, I guess.
Awesome.
So what got you into that immediately?
Yeah. Well, sorry, guys.
No, sorry. So what got you into doing the restoration start of it for you?
Ooh, that grew out of collecting and making. You know, for me, I was somebody that even as a kid loved making things as much as I did owning things. And I mean, I had the collector bug full on. You know, Kenner came out with Star Wars toys and I wanted every single one of these things. You know, that was,
yeah.
And then Marvel Comics started coming out. I was like, okay, I've got to get as many of these as I possibly can. But in collecting stuff, nobody ever seemed to make the stuff I wanted to collect. So, or also sometimes when you're a kid, you don't have the money to buy the things that you want to buy, even if they do exist. So I just started making stuff to have it because I loved it. And also because, you know, we were all film nuts and things like that growing up, and we all wanted to make little movies in the backyard and in the basement. And, you know, so like everything was an excuse to make props. It was always like, oh, we're going to do a puppet thing so we can make puppets. We're going to do this thing so we can make, you know, Ghostbusters gear. We're going to do this so we can make Star Wars stuff. Like, it was all just an excuse to make things. And making monsters really was the thing that resonated for me, though. In making monsters, you learn how to fix monsters, because you're not always good at making monsters, at least initially. And, sure. You know, so even when I wasn't the best at making monsters, I got good at fixing monsters. And that grew into a fascination with plussing things up and improving things. And like, sometimes I would take a licensed collectible that came out that looked pretty good, but then say, well, I can make this look more like the movie. So I would get it and then I would mess with it. And people were like, what are you doing? You're going to ruin it, you know? And all of that sort of tied into this big influx in collecting original movie memorabilia that happened in the late 90s, early 2000s. And, you know, I was in with the right group of people that was collecting this stuff. And they saw that I had a talent for fixing things up, and it turned into something that became like a real passion. And the conservative side of it, the conservation side of it, was something that I got very obsessive about. And there's a way to fix stuff that's like the effects guy way to fix things, which is like, oh, okay, I have to fix this just long enough till, you know, Richard Marquin says cut, you know. There's the other side of it, which is like, okay, I have to fix this in a way that's gonna, you know, do no harm to the piece, but also help make it last longer, not, you know, just last long enough. And that became this real long-term thing of investigation and experimentation and learning and, you know, diving into what museums are doing and what museum conservators do and the materials they use and figuring out how can I morph that into something that ties into, you know, the hand of the effects sculptor, but the knowledge of the conservator, and marry those up in a way where you can take those materials but use these skills and maybe some new materials that we figured out, and we really hit on something. And you know, if you go to tomspinadesigns.com, you can click through the main galleries, and there's one for sculpture, theme props, displays, and restoration. And in the restoration, you'll see before and afters of stuff that were done either by me or folks on the crew, in particular, Patrick Louis, who's my top, you know, right-hand man when it comes to restoration stuff. And it's just, you know, it's really fun stuff to look at, the before and after, and to see where this started, where it landed, or you know, sometimes see like, oh, here's something where maybe it doesn't look drastically different, but now it's conserved and now it's going to last a lot longer. And you know, the sometimes having that light touch is a really unique experience. Anyway, that's how that kind of came about.
Man, that's incredible. And it's super cool to hear you talk about how you got into collecting like more props or movie memorabilia in like the late 90s, early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken. Do you have any Star Wars props in your collection that were used for the actual films?
I've got some. If I may ask. No, I'm kidding. It's funny. I'm always cautious because like, I don't want to be like, you know, this big braggy, like, oh, look what I got kind of guy. But it's also like amazing to share this stuff. You know, it's like the whole reason that I think, you know, it's like people collect because they want things, but they collect to connect. You know, it's like we collect as a group, we collect as friends, we collect as family. And, you know, there are people that became lifelong friends of mine that I met in the late 90s on the Replica Prop Forum that we all only would have, like, there's no reason for any of us to ever become friends other than the fact that we were obsessed with collecting the same stuff. And it turned out that was enough, you know? And it's really, really cool that way. So, yeah, you know, share a little bit. I'm very, very lucky in that I started collecting screen use stuff when a lot of people were still really focused on replicas. And I got into the screen use stuff before it was unobtainable money-wise. If I had to collect now, I'd have, you know, maybe two pieces in my whole collection. Yeah. But for me, the big thing, you know, ever since like literally the first time I looked at the Star Wars storybook and flipped through to the page where the cantina was, the die was cast on my life. Like everything that came after like, and I still have the book. I'm pointing, like, you guys know where it is. It's in the cabinet over there.
Yeah.
I still have that book, and it's got my name scrawled in the covers on the inside like 10 times because I didn't want anybody at school taking it from me. You know, like,
yeah.
I want to make sure they knew this was mine. And that, like, it genuinely, like, this is it. I saw it, and I told my parents, like, I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. They're like, you can't go to space. And I'm like, no, not that. Like, I'm going to make – like, someone made this, and that's me. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, some of my favorite pieces that I've got that are screen-used are screen-used things from the Cantina scene.
Very cool.
I'm lucky enough that I've gotten to know a lot of the folks that worked on the movies. You know, so through those kind of relationships and through places like Prop Store, which is, you know, obviously one of the most amazing and trustworthy places out there for folks who are looking for original material. Yeah. I've got a handful of the original masks that were in the movie that are really just some of the most special things in the world to me. They bring a lot of emotional value and a lot of meaning to them. And wow. It's just, yeah, it amazes me every time I look. I'm like, why is that here? That doesn't make any sense.
Wow. That's awesome.
That's extremely cool.
So one question I had to ask was, is there like a class in college that you can take to get to do what you do? I mean, Is there like a specific thing that you have to take to get in that category? Or is there even a degree for this?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, there are degrees and there are schools that do things in you know, preservation arts and things like that for people who want to go into, you know, more museum preservation. And a lot of that's focused on, you know, hard surface statues or paper goods, you know, and canvas and things like that. And obviously some textile stuff. When it comes to repairing slip latex, foam latex, polyurethane foam, the various urethanes and things that they use in movies, there's really not. It's a lot of it is stuff that we had to kind of develop as we went. And, you know, it's actually kind of fascinating to me that I guess a lot of it comes down to, you know, there's a small amount of this material in general compared to textiles and paper and all of that other stuff. Yeah. But it's starting to pick up and have this enormous value to it. And, you know, archives are popping up that where, you know, maybe movie studios just had this stuff in a warehouse. And now they're realizing, oh, wait, that warehouse is millions of dollars worth of props. Maybe we should care about this. And really, over the last couple of decades, they've started to do that more. And we've been really lucky. We've gotten to work with the Henson Archives on a bunch of material there. A lot of the stuff that we did there went, there was a touring exhibit they did and then a permanent exhibit in New York. If you ever happen to get to New York and you like movies and TV and stuff, there's a place called the Museum of the Moving Image that is really, really great. It's in Queens, New York, and they've got this unbelievably great Muppet exhibit that Henson family donated, I think, like 400 items to them. And we got to help conserve a bunch of that. And shortly after that, we then did a project with the Lucasfilm Archives up at Skywalker Ranch and, you know, conserved a whole bunch of material there. And, you know, it's, you sit there and you go like, okay, you know, here's little five-year-old Tom reading this Cantina book and going, I want to see this stuff. I want to make this stuff. I want to do this. And then, you know, to be able to be surrounded by the real stuff and to be helping keep the real stuff around for future generations to maybe have that same little spark of inspiration. Like, oh man, that's freaking cool.
Wow. How far is that museum in Queens from the LaGuardia Airport out there?
Not far at all, actually, from LaGuardia. It's maybe like 15, 20 minutes.
No way. So yeah. I was actually out there. My boss and I went on a trip to Alabama and we had a layover back to Michigan. We got stuck in Queens overnight and we stayed like just outside of LaGuardia. Man, if I knew that, I would have like walked over there.
Oh man.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I'll get back out there eventually, but
next time you're in. Oh boy, that's a question.
that's a question we are definitely all wanting to ask. So okay, we might as well start ripping with this question here.
I will probably call myself lucky like 100 times as we talk. I do feel very lucky to know Phil. We actually just put up today on the Regal Robot YouTube page a conversation that I had with Phil about the Wampa puppet that he did for Empire. So if anybody's curious about that, Phil is intimidating in a way that I think some of the other guys aren't. But I will say this, Phil is also very funny. You know, in certain situations, he has a very serious air. And I feel lucky that I get to know him in other situations where he doesn't. And, you know, there's a really fun side of him. And he has been so generous with us in building up this archive collection we've been doing with Regal Robot and working with us on previous editions and you know, putting up with a lot of questions from me. You know, I go back to when we were restoring stuff for the Lucasfilm archives. I was at Phil's studio for something and we were going to lunch and it was a short walk away. So we all walked together. It was like 10 of us that all went to lunch at the same time. And on the way to lunch, I'm like, okay, we had the original Max Rebo costume to conserve. And it's literally the only one that I'm allowed to talk about from that whole project. And it kills me because the other stuff was fucking amazing. Pardon my language. I knew he made that. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to go, you know, and this is now 10 years ago, I'm realizing. I said, let me go ask Phil about this. And so I asked him, I'm like, you know, because in my, it was a really tough restoration. And outside looking in, it was really challenging for us to figure out that right approach. And I wanted to know more about what was inside of this thing before I really settled on how we were going to do it. And so I asked him kind of sheepishly, and he kind of gives me this like, how the hell do I know? It was 40 years ago, you know, kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah. Well, that's it. Phil Tippett is never going to talk to me again, you know? Yeah. we went to lunch and we're walking back to the studio on the way back. And I feel a hand on my shoulder and it's Phil putting his arm around me. And he goes, so the inside was a reticulated foam and I carved it up with scissors and a turkey carver. And then there was slip latex here and the foam latex on the head. And he went through the whole thing, start to finish. Wow. And I guess he just needed to get his brain around it. And as soon as it clicked back in his brain, he came and, you know, was happy to share with me. And I was so glad he did. It gave me exactly what I needed to know going into this thing. So, I mean, you know, there's hot Phil and cold Phil, I guess, but it is always great. And those are the sorts of things that he's been so gracious about putting up with me. Cause mm-hmm. I will ask these really, really tiny, minuscule type questions about how something was done 40 years ago, 45 years ago, almost 50 years ago sometimes. Mm. And he's good. Most of the time he's got an answer and there's, you know, and sometimes the answer is, I don't know, but a lot of times he's got great information. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's very cool. Cause I know Ray was asking if you could, you know, go to school and get a degree for something like this. But back in the day, those guys all were kind of the first of their kind in a sense with doing something like that. And
And they were building on stuff that was done before.
Yes.
Which is, you know, I mean, that's what we all do, right? We take what came before and then you try and put your spin on it. And we're just lucky that they all had so much spin, you know,
yeah.
to look at. You know, that group of people. I mean, even if you're just talking Cantina, right? You had Stuart Freeborn and Nick Maley and Chris Tucker and obviously Kay Freeborn and Graham Freeborn. And I'm losing another name, but a couple other folks in England, all talents, all people that went on to do other amazing things, you know, even after Star Wars. And then you come to Rick Baker's crew who did all the pickup shots for the Cantina. And there you have, you know, Rick Baker, Phil Tippett, John Berg, Doug Beswick, Lane Liska, Rob Bottin, who was like 17 at the time. He was like this giant kid, you know? And you like the amount of talent that was in that one little room. And, you know, what you have to kind of realize is like, okay, Rick and Rob had made a ton of rubber masks at that point, but Phil and John and Doug were stop motion guys. You know, they were used to making little monsters and you know, so their sitting there learning on the job and in the process creating Hammerhead and the Duros and the Cantina Band and, you know, all this amazing stuff that wow. this great Star Wars stuff, if I can drop the name of the podcast.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, I mean, you know, this is incredible. But, you know, what's great is because they were stop motion guys, they forgot things like, oh, the person in this mask might need to see or might need to breathe. Yeah, so like right. John Berg did the an alien called The Given, which kind of looks like a scream mask kind of face, like this kind of skull
face.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's based on a tiny little sketch that Ralph McQuarrie did. And then John expanded that and turned it into a full thing. And it's a really cool sculpt. It was always one of my favorites. I don't know why. It's barely even in the movie. I don't even think it made like the final cut. But John only put a hole in the mouth. And so if you're wearing that mask, and the mouth has an underbite too. So even though there's a hole, the teeth and the underbite hide you from being able to see anything. So he said he was the one who had to wear it for the movie. And he goes, so he puts this thing on. And it's like, okay, somebody show me where the chair is. You know, like it's like, like nothing.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, they learned on the job and thank goodness they did. And I just, the amount of creativity and the amount of ingenuity, you know, you expand beyond that. And, you know, Dennis Muir and Ken Ralston and John Dykstra and all the Lorne Peterson and Grant McEwen in the model shop and Steve Gawley, all of these talents. Like, it's just, it's bonkers. You can't even, you know, you can't imagine that much talent in one place.
Yeah. Man, that's crazy. And Tom, it's funny that you brought up the Max Rebo costume.
Oh, yeah.
So for excuse me. So for our listeners out there, one of our co-hosts, Colin, is very, very passionate about Max Rebo. And we have a debate that we might need some insight on. So we definitely go back and forth arguing whether Max Rebo has two arms and two legs or I guess
just his legs and his hands are one.
Yeah, it seems like it's open to interpretation. So
I have a couple of answers on this. So for the last Star Wars celebration, they had me as a guest doing a panel on the Return of the Jedi aliens. I was there with Jason and Gabe from Blast Points podcast, which is great. Sorry to mention a podcast on your channel.
That's okay. But
they're outstanding guys. And we had so much fun with it. We had Kirk Thatcher there, who was a guy that worked on Return of the Jedi and also, you know, worked on tons of movies after that. And in fact, he was a producer on Star Trek IV, the one with the whales. He plays the punk on the bus that Spock does the nerve pinch to. And he even wrote the song, the punk song that's playing. Like, he's super talented guy and a load of fun.
I mean, he also came back in Picard as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Dude, that's so cool.
So this was a debate we wanted to settle. So number one, and at that show, we had released a Max Rebo maquette that was Phil Tippett's original concept for Max Rebo. And if anybody wants to go to our website, you could even find a picture of that. It's on.
I think we got one here for you, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Ray put one up. We'll get it up here in just a second. Yeah. Let's see.
So this maquette, to us, we thought told the whole story, but then it didn't. And I'll blow your mind with that in a minute. So that is the maquette. And if you can find another angle, maybe like a three-quarter or a side view, I don't know if you're on the product page there, but. And for anybody who is interested, that is scanned off of Phil Tippett's original maquette sculpt at Skywalker Ranch, the Lucasfilm archives. Wow. And it was part of the kickoff for this maquette series we've been doing. We had done a couple before, but this is when we really said, okay, you know, we're going to go through all of these at the archives and we're going to try and make as many as we can.
Yeah.
So if you can pull us up another shot. The original concept is he has one pair of limbs and that's it, right? So it's just the Kenner figure made him, you know, gave him a butt and a diaper and little legs. That was someone at Kenner, you know, just going and doing their own thing. And someone at Lucasfilm approved it, But the original concept for that species is he is sitting on top of that organ, not in the organ.
Really?
I was actually hoping when they had him back in the Book of Boba Fett, yeah. I was like, oh man, today with today's tech, it would be so easy to have the actor wear a green screen suit around his waist and right, have Max pop up once or twice and just, you know, have green screen out the bottom to the background plate so that it looks like he's sitting on top of the thing, because everybody just assumes he's inside the organ and it's like, no, it's not supposed to be.
Wow. That is crazy.
But here's the weird thing. And if you can pull up any picture of him, just to show folks as I say this, because this is where you have to kind of see it to not unsee it. But
yeah, here
we were painting the maquettes at our studio, and one of this is perfect too. So yeah, you can even see like his butt is flattened out, and he's sitting on that, right?
Yeah.
So we were painting those at the studio, and one of the women who's painting comes to me later and says, is this amount of spotting right on his flippers? And I'm like, his what? And she's like, his flippers. And I'm like, no, he has ears, you know, like very condescending. Like those are Max's ears.
Right.
So then I go back into the office and I'm like, well, damn it. Now I have to ask Phil. So I ask Phil and he says, and I just said, I'm like, what would you call these? And I just pointed at him and he said, oh, those are his flippers.
Shut the front door.
So Max Rebo has two legs that come up and over, and that's what he plays the thing with. And then he's got like penguin flippers. And what ended up happening is, you know, this is obviously the concept. By the time they made the costume and someone's wearing it, the legs, you know, you can't put your arm like this. Right. So the legs went from going up and over to just going out to the side like someone's arms do. And the flippers got higher on his head. So they look like ears on a blue elephant. So, you know, where he ended up is its own thing. But where the intention was, he plays his piano with his feet. He does not have a lower half. He sits on top of his organ. And these are freaking flippers.
Wow. That's so cool. Oh my gosh. I love learning stuff like that. Even the smallest little details. That's incredible.
How great that, like, you know, Return of the Jedi came out, what, 41 years ago this year? Yeah. And we're still learning stuff. Like we're still discovering things. Like what movie does that?
Yeah. You don't have something like that. That's not in every movie franchise. I'll tell you that for free.
No.
That's incredible. It was a little before my time when Return of the Jedi came out, but I saw it in theaters last year when it came out.
Oh, nice.
My wife and I went and saw it, and there were guys probably twice my age in that theater that cheered when the Death Star blew up. And I'm like, you know what? This is Star Wars. Like we're just in the theater. You guys have seen this movie 10 times and we're all here having a good time.
Yeah. 10. That's how many.
Yeah. Right. In the Phantom Menace, I expect nothing different. You know what I mean?
Oh man, that's gonna be nuts.
It's gonna be a little crazy.
It's gonna be awesome.
It's great to hear that. It's nice that, you know, I'm glad you had the opportunity to see it in the theater. I know it was probably special edition, which is all right. But it's such a different thing to see it in a theater with an excited crowd, you know, it's like an event. And it's
for sure,
you know, this shared energy that comes out of that. You just don't get that watching it at home on the TV while you're scrolling on your phone and, you know, doing stuff. Yeah,
absolutely. I was telling my coworkers today. Tom, I'm sorry. I do this every once in a while, but I was born in the year 2000. So that was before or after the Phantom Menace came out.
I just threw a hip. Hang on. All right. No, I'm okay now. You can go ahead. Okay.
And I hear from everyone else on the podcast who was around for the promo time for the Phantom Menace talk about how hype it was. And it's just so incredible. And my coworkers today were talking about how they took the day off when the movie came out, like, cause they went and waited in line, went to the midnight release and all that stuff back when it was still at midnight. And oh my gosh, the hype just sounded unreal.
It was insanity. The only thing, it's funny, I don't know. And retro, Ray, being retro, you might remember the Batman 1989 release.
Oh, dude, that, okay, mind you, we didn't have, like right now, we just got the trailer drop for Deadpool. That was awesome. Right. We didn't have that. The only way you got to see deals was in magazines, and that was it. Nothing else.
Even then, it was like, you know, the information you were getting was already 2 months old by the time the magazine got it, and who knows when you picked it up at the store, you know? Yeah. It's you know, the 89 Batman, I remember, was the first movie where I really, really remember that like hype train going and all of this energy. And then for Phantom Menace, oh my God, like that was just bonkers. Even the special editions, I mean, yeah, like we made a big deal with my friends of going and seeing the special editions first night, first showing, lining up, all of that stuff. And just seeing that first trailer where, you know, and I, you know, so I don't know if you've ever, Zach, you've ever seen the trailer for the special editions, but
I can't say I have.
Okay. So you should look it up, because here's what they did in a movie theater on a giant screen. They had a little television in the center of the screen. Like that's the image. And the television has, you know, a little bit of the space battle from the first Star Wars. And the announcer goes like, for a generation, the only way to see Star Wars has been on the small screen or something along those lines. Mm. And then the X-Wing flies through that full screen again. And they give you a whole bunch of cuts from the movie. And everybody in that movie theater jumped out of their seats. And this is like, we had no idea that was coming, though. You know what I mean? Yeah. We didn't know we were going to get a trailer for that. Oh. We had no way. No one on the internet told us, okay, if you go see this movie, you'll get this trailer. No, it was like, we're going to the movies. And I was like, what the? Oh man, that was crazy. That was a fun time.
Wow. That's incredible. And I heard people talking about like buying movie tickets to go watch the Phantom Menace trailer and then go leave. Like there are people that go on their lunch breaks and go watch the Phantom Menace trailer and go back to work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's incredible. I know many people who went to see the Phantom Menace trailer and then left. I actually stayed, but I know a lot of people. Yeah, meet Joe Black. There you go. Yeah, thanks for the backup, Tim.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's incredible. My coworkers were talking about that trailer and like, just look up the trailer. It was insanely hype. And I watched it and I'm like, man, I could watch this whole movie on my phone that's in my pocket right now, but I'm excited to go see it in the theater. Want that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very different time, you know, when I was a kid and trying to make this stuff, like we didn't even have a VHS player at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I think we got our VHS player around 1983, 1984, because Ghostbusters was one of the first movies I had on VHS. And I mean, that's phenomenal right there. I would have to be going by things in like the storybook if I was trying to, you know, come up with a replica of something, or, you know, because you saw the movie, I think I saw Empire twice. I saw it once in a regular theater and once in a drive-in. And then that was it. Then I had the storybook and that was how I, you know, and then the toys, and that was Empire Strikes Back for me. You know, it was trying to make stop motion movies with my Tauntaun Kenner figure. It was, you know, taking my AT-AT out into the snow when it snowed in New York and, you know, trying and setting things up, and then finding a rebel soldier in the middle of the lawn because somehow I must've forgot him in the snow. And when it thawed out, there he was, you know, 6 months later or something. You know, that's all we had. And it's so strange to think about that now because, you know, we're doing all the research on our projects and things like that. It's like, okay, you know, we'll get a 4K of the movie. We'll pause it anywhere we want. We'll Zoom. We have access to all these amazing behind the scenes images through Lucasfilm and all of that stuff. We get to go to the ranch and examine the real props and all of this stuff. And I'm like,
wow.
I remember when VHS first came out, pausing the VHS and sketching a proton pack because I wanted to build one, you know? Wow. And so I would like pause it, and you couldn't leave a pause too long because it would break the tape. Like it would, you know, you'd get dropouts in the tape if you held it too long. So I'd always like, I'd do it and I'd like look at the clock. I'm like, okay, I have 3 minutes, and I'd sketch, you know, and try and figure out what to make stuff out of it. It's just, kids today will never know.
That's so cool. Oh my
god. Well, since you bring that up, Tom.
Yeah.
Okay, Zach, you probably will never see commercials like this.
What's a commercial? Sorry.
These commercials. No. Okay. So when they sold us our toys.
Yes.
Remember these commercials? They would have them playing in this big area. They would have like everything on nice and neat and everything.
Yeah.
And it was like that made you want to go buy the toy and do the same thing.
Yeah. Or it'd be like in this great like set with little mountains and sand and everything. Mm. And it's just like, you know, they're playing in this miniature version of, you know, Tunisia or whatever. It's like, how? Like, yeah. Oh, yeah. Love that stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. We constantly refer back to those too, you know. It's like
nice.
Rob at the shop, every once in a while I'll just hear him go like, surprise surprise, Lando in disguise, and that's from one of the old Kenner commercials, you know. Or somebody says Wampa, they always have to go Wampa 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 Wampa, you know, because the kid in that commercial for whatever reason thought Wampa's said Wampa because it was like Pikachu, what is going on here. See, I'm hip. I know things.
That's good. And Pokemon was a little before my time, even. I hate to say that. But
oh, dang, dude, for real.
That was, what, 94? I don't know. Sorry. I'll shut up. But no, I appreciate that. That's awesome.
So I got a story for you guys. So I was at a convention, and Larry Hama was there. And I was going to try to get an interview with him, but you know, we're busy manning the table. But I got to talk to him for a few seconds just to get his contact info to do an interview like this. And while we were talking, he saw, you know, I don't have it right now, but I have a Star Wars Stuff podcast one. And he's like, I was like, so when was the first time you saw Star Wars? He's like, man, I remember this. He's like, him, Neil Adams, Chris Claremont, all stood in line to go watch it when it first came out. And they watched it together. Yeah. And he was like, when we went, we were just amazed seeing, you know, the destroyer coming over, and he said we all geeked out. And I was like, to hear that story from Larry Hama, who then turned around later and creates G.I. Joe figures for us kids, it was just so amazing hearing that story from him. And that's the thing, you're pretty much doing almost what Larry does. The difference is bigger scale, you know, recreating the toys that we had as kids, but
for us
as adults.
It's so funny because like you talk to anyone who's in any kind of creative industry, that especially, I mean, if they're on the nerdy side of things, there is literally before and after Star Wars. It is a divider in time. And, you know, you can't go back to before that. Before doesn't exist anymore. It's like, as soon as Star Wars happens, it's like, well, that's it. Everything's different now. And for us, I don't know, you know, how much of this is us trying to find our way back to that playground, try to find our way back to that little sand pit with the rocks and, you know, the dewback wiggling his tail and moving his head and stuff like that. You know, for me, owning props, replica or even the real one, are about that connection to the movie. It's about, you know, more so than toys, more so than paintings and pictures and autographs and everything. It's like feeling like you're surrounded by the things that made the movie and feeling like you could be walking out onto that set maybe, or feeling like, you know, at any minute, Dennis Muren might come in and say like, all right, we got to take this model and shoot it, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, especially when you get a screen use prop that is a one of a kind, is something that was, you know, which doesn't always happen. There's usually multiples, but sometimes you can screen match something and say like, for sure, this is the one used in this particular scene.
Yeah.
To be around something like that, not even to own it, but just to be around it. It's like energy and magic. And, you know, it's like being around a celebrity. You know, one of the first times I went to the Skywalker Ranch archives, I mean, top of my list. There's only a handful of things. I went in like, whatever I see, this is going to be the greatest time in my entire life. You know, like no matter what, I am good. However, ooh, if I could see that Wampa puppet, Like that was so high on my list. The other one that was high on my list was Walrus Man's Head because I knew they had that. They don't have any of the other Cantina stuff. A lot of that stayed with Stuart Freeborn or other people that worked on the movies. Walrus Man came back for Return of the Jedi. He's in the background of Jabba's Palace. And so they must have held on to it after the movie for whatever reason. And unfortunately, at the time, Walrus Man was on a tour. I think he was like in Japan or something like that. So I didn't get to see him that trip. And I was so disappointed by that. But I did get to see that Wampa. And that so this is Phil Tippett's puppet Wampa. And it, like I said, it felt like I was seeing a celebrity. It gave me goosebumps to see this thing and to be close to it. And it's, you know, and it still does. Every time we go there, it's just nuts. And oh gosh, sorry, I just looked at the next question.
Yeah, here we go. Tim Seitz was asking, were you invited or did you break in like fanboys?
No comment. No, we were very much invited. I feel very fortunate for that. I think the movie exaggerates the level of ease in the break-in. It would be a very hard thing to actually do.
That's crazy.
But it's definitely a nice place to be invited. I will say that. And I feel I'm really happy that, you know, so we had been a lot prior to even starting Regal Robot, but I'm very glad that once we started Regal Robot that, you know, we were able to kind of build on that relationship with them and to get all of the approvals we needed from Lucasfilm and Disney to, you know, really go in and investigate and, you know, research that ever-loving, you know, stuff out of these things. And, you know, that means we're measuring things, we're color matching things, we're bringing in hair samples and comparing them on stuff. We're doing laser scans of things so that we've got high resolution copies of them. It's, you know, from the most low tech to high tech in terms of research, we've done it all. And it's, it allows us to make what we're doing with Regal Robot that much more authentic and faithful, I guess is a good word for it.
Man, that's incredible. Can you share a little bit more on that, Tom, on what the process is like to go to Skywalker Ranch and get into that archive area? And like, I don't know, do they make you take everything out of your pockets? Like, you have to put on special shoes? Do you have to wear gloves?
That was only the first time. Yeah, after that. Yes, you do have to wear gloves if you're going to be handling anything. Generally speaking, you're not handling things, though. You know, they have archives team that – you know, kind of they're in charge of moving things and they're in charge of things, you know, so we try to keep hands off as much as possible. It's museum protocols. But there are times where you do have to get in and do that. And the fact that we have, you know, this prior relationship with them where we've done restoring and things like that, they know we're respectful of this material. They know we know how to handle it and that, you know, we're not going to put anything at risk in what we're doing. And it's one of the things I really like about, you know, the ability to 3D scan stuff. You know, back in the day, and I'm not even talking far back in the day, the only option you had was to make a mold of something if you wanted to get a direct copy of it. And that was the way to have lineage back to the original. Well, you know, most of these things wouldn't survive being molded. You would put them in, you know, silicone or plaster or whatever you're doing, and you'd destroy the original taking it out of the mold just to be able to make your copy. But now it's, you know, you can make almost a hands-off mold of this thing digitally. Wow. You can get, you know, within fractions of a millimeter accuracy on these scans. Every little wrinkle and wart and pimple and bump and all of that stuff. And it's been an incredible tool for us. And it's something that, you know, we really dove into, especially when the 3D printers got high enough resolution to output those things at full resolution, which was the hang up for the longest time. And it's really nice that balance has kind of shifted to where, you know, you can scan stuff at a high resolution, you can output things at a high resolution, and you can, and then from there we can make molds and cast and make duplications and things like that as needed for a production run. You know, in terms of getting in there, so yeah, there's no Thankfully, no crazy searches or anything like that. They don't have this wearing like transparent outfits. Thank goodness no one needs to see that. You know, but you have to be invited on property. You have to have a business reason to be there. If you're lucky and you're there for an extended amount of time, there's actually an inn on Skywalker Ranch property where we stay when we're working there for a few days, which is is really amazing and awesome on it in its own right.
It's definitely
beautiful and peaceful and inspiring. And honestly, you know, George's whole point in making that was he wanted a place to make movies in a new way, right? He wanted his place to be inspired and to write and to art direct and you know, come up with ideas for things. And holy hell, did he succeed? It's you go there and you're just just walking on property, you're like instantly inspired. And then, you know, to be able to go into the archives, it's, you know, it's something that shifts a little over time. It ebbs and flows a little bit sometimes, depending on what they're working on. It's and depending on the licensee and you know what your relationship is like there. Sometimes it's okay, you're gonna give us a list of things to see and you're gonna go in a plain white room and we're gonna bring you just those things. And other times, you know, I especially back in the old days, it was very loose and you could go and walk around and you know, look till your heart's content at stuff, which my heart would never be content. There's just always something to see.
Oh, yes.
And I will say, no matter how many times we've been, every single time we are spotting multiple new things that we didn't even know were there or didn't know still existed, or learning, you know, some insane fact about some prop that we never thought of in a million years. And it's just, it's much like the movies. It keeps on giving.
Oh, incredible.
So we got a question from one of our fans here for you.
So is this the, like, you know, the archives is on fire and you have to grab one thing and run question, you know?
Yeah. So for our listeners, I'll read it for you guys. Tim Seitz was saying, do you have a favorite prop/replica/memorabilia item in the archives?
Oh, okay. So my top two that I mentioned before being the Wampa puppet and the Walrus Man head, which thankfully did come back to the archive some years later, and I've gotten to see him on numerous trips now and examine and scan and all that fun stuff.
Very cool.
Those two are very, very high on my list. Nice. Let's see, gosh. If for some reason those were inaccessible, and this is going to be the dumbest thing in the world because it's probably, like, you know, definitely not the most valuable thing there, but they have the head of a Jerba, which is a pack animal that sits outside the cantina next to the D-Bac.
Yeah.
You barely see him on screen. He's got this big dopey dog face. And it was made by Fred Pearl, the same guy who made the D-Bac. And I'm obsessed with the D-Bac, by the way. So that Jerba head is still there. And the first time I went on a tour of the archives, they walked us through the whole thing. And the head of the archives was with us at the time. And she's an amazing woman. And we go through the whole thing. And at the very end, she's like, okay, here's our contest that we ask everybody on their first tour. And, you know, and nobody has ever gotten it yet. And she starts pointing and I'm like, oh my God, you have the Jerba. And she's like, how did you even know that? You know, it's like, I'm slightly obsessed. But yeah, that is one of those things that is so connected to the first film for me. And that is, there's a specialness to that where you have something like, oh, well, you know, they really, it just, you know what? It's funny because they actually reused that prop. The reason it's in the archives is because they took that Jerba and a Tauntaun head and they put them on the wall next to Han Solo in carbonite in Jabba's palace as trophy mounts. So that would be why they kept that all these years, because they must've brought it back. They must've, you know, gotten it or kept it around and put it up in Jabba's palace and luckily brought it back and it still exists today. So yeah, that's a pretty cool piece.
Man, that's incredible. So you must watch the Industrial Light and Magic documentary and go, oh, I've seen that. Oh, I've seen that. Oh, I wish I've seen that. But
yeah, it's funny. We, my wife gets mad. Cause I think that, so depending on the documentary, like the old documentaries, yeah, I love seeing stuff and figuring out like, oh yeah, we saw that. Or like sometimes there's something in the documentary in the background and you never knew what it was. But then once you see it in the archives, you're like, oh, that's, you know, Herb Yodel's head or whatever, you know. But I remember watching the Light and Magic documentary, and John Berg has just become a great friend to me over the last decade or so. And he's a really special guy, very, very sweet. My wife absolutely loves him, and he loves her, and lucky to have him in our lives. And he wasn't in that, and she was beside herself that they did not ask him in that, you know. And he felt like, well, other people were more important, the whole ILM thing. I was just kind of there, but she was just like, "Where's John?" You know.
Yeah.
But we're watching, and it's like, you know, oh yeah, there's so and so. I just was at his house. Oh, there's so and so. We had dinner the other day. Oh, there's so and so. We went to his studio, and you know, we're seeing all these people, and it's like, yeah, it's the props, but then the people, and you know, getting to know those guys and girls is the craziest part of all of this, and you know, to be able to talk shop with them and stuff. If people go to, you know, so there's the Regal Robot YouTube page. There's also Tom Spina Designs on YouTube, one word. I've got on that page, I've got the long form interviews that I've done with a lot of these folks. Mm-hmm. And so there's ones with, you know, John Berg and Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett. There's ones with Ken Ralston, Dave Carson, Judy Elkins, Jeannie Lauren. And Chris Wayless, there's a great one with Chris Wayless. And so, yeah, I mean, if you want to see these folks in a really relaxed setting, just kind of talking off the cuff and not giving you sound bites in a very produced documentary, it's a good way to get a sense of who they are and what they're into. And I like to think that I ask different kind of questions than they would get in Something for the Masses. This is, you know, it's a lot of shop talk, and it's a lot of, you know, what was your process? What was your reasoning? What was behind that? You know, and I love sitting down with these folks and hearing their stories.
Well, man, we love the stories you're giving us as well.
Yeah, right? I could do this for hours. This is incredible. Man, the things I've learned today. Holy cow.
I know. We're already going almost in an hour. We're 52 minutes in. And
yeah,
we haven't even gotten to a lot of the stuff that we wanted to talk to you about. But it's just
that's okay. Fun.
Yeah, I mean, everything we're getting from you. Yeah, I mean, sure. Everything you're telling us is, I mean, I'm just like taking everything in and just listening to you.
Oh.
Because okay, growing up as a kid, like you said, you know, you had these books, and that's the closest we got at that time because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have any of that. So when you saw the, you know, the props and everything, and to me, I wish we could go back to half props, half CGI.
Yeah.
Because to me, even though there were a lot of props, because if you think about it, okay, going into it, a lot of the backgrounds for the troopers in like Return of the Jedi and Star Wars are actual paintings that people already know. And they look so lifelike, you think they're actually backgrounds. You know what I mean? So just you getting to see all that stuff, I'm so like, wow.
I'm jealous of myself hearing you talk about it like that. I never lose sight, and you know, Rob at the studio, Rob DiNicola is our creative director. He and I, on the Regal Robot side of things, are, you know, we're the ones that set the course in terms of what products we're going to be making and all of our development and stuff. And we tend to go to a lot of these archives trips together. Every time we go, we're like, it doesn't get old. It doesn't feel less special. It doesn't feel like we're any less fortunate. You know, every time we go, we're like, we're the luckiest freaking kids in the world. You know, this is every Star Wars kid's dream is to go up to the gates of Skywalker Ranch and tell them your name and have them go like, okay, come on in. You know, it's like every time we go, we're sure. We're like, oh, this is going to be the time they figure it out. Right. They're gonna, like,
yeah.
What was that, Spina? Son of a, we didn't know that was you. Get out of here. You know?
Yeah.
No, yeah. With you, you know, okay. You getting back to me for this podcast, like you stated, you know, you group of friends doing the restorations of the stuff and collecting Star Wars. This is basically what we were, because of David, who our founder of Star Wars, a podcast, one of them, and then James, you know, bought us together as a team for everything that we loved and getting to talk to about Star Wars, the way we love Star Wars, us getting to meet you. I feel the way you felt with Tippett because you are a part of Star Wars that we grew up watching, and you're restoring what we love. And then not just doing that, creating things as us collectors can come out and buy and add to our collection. So it's so cool that we're getting to talk to you today and you taking the time to come talk to us about this stuff.
It's awfully kind of you, man. Thank you.
No, I mean, seriously, man, I just, when you responded back to me, I was like, no way. He actually got back to me. I was like, because, you know, there's some people, they'll be like, yeah, they just blow you off. You know what I mean? Yeah. But you actually taking the time and do everything like this. And then, you know, especially this time at night, you know, coming on the interview with us, you know, you didn't have to do any of that. Yeah. But we appreciate you taking the time to do all this as well.
Thanks, man. No, it's so fun chatting this stuff through you know, making new friends. And like, I mean, this is, it's funny. So, because we have this new release coming up on the 20th, this is actually my fourth podcast in 4 days.
Oh, wow.
At like 10 o'clock at night. And then I've still got, I think I've got 4 or 5 more before next Tuesday still. So it's going to be a busy week, but, you know, still having fun, right? It's like we're sitting around talking Star Wars. I could be digging ditches or climbing a pole or, you know, doing work, you know, like this is, to be able to go into the shop every day and do stuff we love and to be, you know, working on original props from all of these different movies, not just Star Wars, but Gremlins and, you know, now I'm starting to blank on all the different movies that are in there in the studio right now. But, you know, Terminator stuff. And you just go through the Tom Spina Designs website. There's just, I mean, you basically pick your favorite movie and search it on the search bar. And we probably worked on something over the last couple decades. And it's just nuts. You go in and it's like, oh, wow, that's an Arnold Schwarzenegger costume from the movie right there in front of me. That's amazing. Or this is from the Deadpool movie. Or this is from, you know, some Marvel movie. Or this is from Star Wars. It's like, it's insane. And, you know, it's like, how do you not smile when you go in? And then to look around at everybody making Regal stuff, and it's just like tables. Right now we go in the back and there's tables of people making these Rancor maquettes that are just starting to go into production. And, you know, we had 5 of these Wampas going into production so we could do our samples and our reviewer copies and things like that. And it's just like, it's the best thing in the world, you know?
Again, guys, this is what will be coming out. This is a photo of the upcoming. So there's going to be just more other items that you're going to be releasing later on too as well, right?
That's true. Yeah. So we've got the Wampa puppet comes out on the 20th. There are 2 editions. One has a signature from Phil Tippett and one has a hand-drawn sketch from Phil with every copy that you get in what we call our legacy edition. And then in March, we have another Indiana Jones prop coming, a 40th anniversary of Temple of Doom prop. I can't say more than that yet. End of March, middle to end, we have another Return of the Jedi maquette coming out. And what those are, much like the Max Rebo, these are the actual concept sculptures for the different characters. We've got a whole line of them that have been going, and it basically gives people the first draft of what this character was going to be. And these are, you know, priceless artifacts in the archives. And I really, really love offering those to folks. Going in later in the year, we have another couple of prop replicas coming out. We have a couple of busts and things going there's plenty on the way. We have a very full schedule for the rest of the year. And anybody who wants to find out more about it, go to regalrobot.com, follow @regalrobot on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, wherever. And if you are on Facebook, look up the Regal Robot Fan and Collector Showcase. That is our Facebook group. It's a really, really fun group of collectors that are like big collectors of our stuff. And there's a lot of fun conversation. And Rob and I are very active there. We try to make sure that we're showing a lot of behind the scenes photos. And anytime we're going to do a first look on, you know, like on either the Regal website or in an email or anything like that, I always try and put it up in the group a few hours or even a day earlier so that, you know, our group members get to see it. There's about 2,500 people now. It's a lot of fun. There's contests. So yeah, please look that up and join us there.
Yeah, we'll share the link on that when we post the video as well.
Thank you.
We'll add that on there as well for people to come and find your page and
join
it as well. Because, I mean, to get new stuff, that's what we do too. So anytime you drop stuff, we tend to share it on our page as well.
Thank you.
You know, because we just don't do interviews. We do, you know, our random talks. We do comic reviews. Because we just love Star Wars. We can't get enough Star Wars, pretty much. That's pretty much it.
That's our kind of people. At the end of the day, we're a very small company. You know, there's like, you know, maybe 20 people working on a day-to-day basis in our New York studio and a handful of people around the country that are freelance that we bring in for overflow. And, you know, that is even split between the two companies. And then there's within that, there's office staff and, you know, artist staff. So, you know, sometimes we'll be doing a maquette run and there's like three people that are painting all of them, you know, in a run of 100 or 150 pieces or something like that. So, you know, we're as such a small company, it's like every time someone shares what we do, it's a benefit to us. Every time somebody, you know, anytime someone buys something from us, that's fantastic. But it's like, if you just like what you see, even if it's not something for you to buy, share it with your friends and say like, hey, look at this. Is this cool? You know, and maybe they'll share it. And, you know, it's always nice to bring new folks in and share what we're doing with people. It's, you know, and to me, the ultimate is when it comes back around and you get someone that's like, oh yeah, I heard you on such podcast. And then I went, and then I bought it, and here's a picture of it in my home, hanging on my wall or in my collection. Like we see customer picks all the time, and that fan group is great for that. And it's like, there is just nothing better than like having put sweat and tears and energy into making something and then having it in someone's house and loved and appreciated. Mm. Like as an artist, you're just like, there's literally nothing better than that.
Mm. Man, that's awesome. That's really, really cool.
Well, like I said, we definitely take, you know, thank you again for coming on and hope to have you back and talk more cool stuff that you're working on. If you got any other stuff that you want to drop, you know, let us know. We're always willing to bring you back.
An open invite with us for sure.
Thank you very much. No, I appreciate that. Yeah. I hope people like listen to the stories and thanks again for that. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Guys.
Anything else, Zach?
I think I'm all set. I'll close this out here. So for Tom, Retro Ray, my name is Zach, and may the force be with you.
Always.